Anyone who's watched sports on TV or attended a game in person has witnessed people who have taken fandom to extremes. They dress in crazy costumes, decorate their homes with team memorabilia, name their kids and pets for their favorite players. Sports journalist George Dorman has spent a lot of time with sports obsessives and with the psychologists who study their behavior. He writes about it in a new book called Superfan: Into the Heart of Obsessive Sports Fandom. George Dorman has written about sports for the LA Times, Sports Illustrated, and is now a senior editor and writer for The Athletic. He was also a reporter for the St. Paul Pioneer Press, and during that assignment won a Pulitzer Prize for reporting he did that uncovered academic fraud in the University of Minnesota's men's basketball program. George Dorman joins us in the studio this morning, happens to live right here in Ashland. George, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So in the introduction to your book, you write about your first really intense experience of fandom when you found yourself being employed on the night desk of the LA Times back in the 1990s, prior to the internet. It wasn't really a sports writing position, but you were hearing from a lot of sports fans. What happened there?
Yeah, it's the worst job at the LA Times, I would say. You sat there from 3 to midnight, and you ran copies and got dinner for people, but you mostly took phone calls. And it was people calling from bars with trivia questions, people calling to just complain about something that was in the paper. They'd yell about, you know, that you covered USC more than UCLA and those kind of things. It was just this onslaught of, you know, fans calling in and, you know, feeling like they needed to be heard.
And that this was obviously prior to the internet, so there were no online forums or chat rooms. I assume there was some, you know, sports radio they could call in and yell at.
Yeah, they could call the sports radio, but really, the LA Times was it. And my editor said simply, look, these are either subscribers or potential subscribers to the Los Angeles Times. So you treat them with respect and you get the answer to their question. You know, you deal with them. And, you know, it was a big joke that when the little copy desk guy, myself, would lose his cool. When someone's yelling at you, you know, eventually, hours after hours, you just finally blow up and you'd just yell at them. And, you know, then everybody would laugh on the desk because you blew it. But, you know, I was probably listening to sports fans more than anyone at that newspaper for about 2 years.
So what about sports fans and fandom made you want to pursue it as a subject for a book?
I think it was a little bit about wanting to understand myself, because I'm a sports fan. I think that's part of it, but I'm not in the book. But there were, you know, I understood my own behavior. But really, you know, throughout the years, especially with the explosion of the internet and social media, we are hearing from fans more and more. And I'm hearing from fans more and more. You know, whenever I write a story, I, on Twitter or Facebook or over emails, I get, you know, you'll get bombarded with people who have an opinion about your article, about the topic, who just want to attack you. I mean, I'm an investigative reporter by trade. For years, I'd write about college programs and I would get death threats. I would get people posting my, you know, my address on a message board and saying, you know, who wants to go there and kill them? Those sort of things. And so I just wanted to understand who these people were. And, you know, how they became such extreme fans. Because I am a fan. I am a diehard fan of certain teams. But I would never go that far. But I just wanted – so I needed to understand these people that, you know, have, for lack of a better term, been my audience, you know, for all these years.
And so you profile some very, very interesting super fans in your book. And we'll get to them in a minute. But you also spend a lot of time – talking with sports psychologists, and one of them who plays a major role in your book is a guy named Dan Juan. Is that the way you pronounce his name? Tell us about him.
Yeah, Dan is he's at Murray State in Murray, Kentucky, and he is the only guy in the country who his primary field of study is sports fans. There are others who dabble in it, you know, who it's a sidelight, but their universities would never let them make a full-time gig out of studying sports fans. But Dan, you know, since he was at the University of Kansas getting his PhD, loved the idea of sports fans and sort of stumbled into the idea of making this his field of study. So he has written hundreds and hundreds of papers about sports fans. This guy knows more than anybody. And, of course, he's also a crazy sports fan himself. You know, Dan has a test, the Sports Spectator Identification Scale, and it's in my book. It's 7 questions, and you go from 1 to 8 when you answer the questions, and you get a total, you know. And Dan's taken the test. He scores in what you would call the extreme range of fandom. So, you know, and I hung out with him. I've watched games with him. We've talked. We played miniature golf at a conference that he hosts, you know, each year. He is a super fan, absolutely. But he's also the guy, the one guy in the country who really, really studies this, you know, day and night.
So you take his test and you find out kind of how far gone you are as a fan, right?
Yeah, you know, so the language that Dan uses is identification. It's how identified, how much of your identity is sort of given over to that team. And so depending on how you score, you know, if you score 56, which would be a perfect score, or maybe not perfect is not the word, but the highest score, you know, Dan would say you are an extremely identified fan, right? If you score 15, you'd say you're a low identified fan. So it really just means how much of you have you invested in that team.
George Dorman is our guest this morning. He's a sports journalist and author of a new book, Superfan, Into the Heart of Obsessive Sports Fandom. How big of a fan are you? Maybe you're way gone as a sports fan, or maybe you don't care for sports at all. But you can join the conversation by calling us at 800-838-3760. Or by email at jx@jeffnet.org. And we'll be back with George Dorman in a few minutes after a break. The Jefferson Exchange here on Jefferson Public Radio. I'm John Baxter, and today for Jeffrey Riley, our guest this morning is George Dorman, who's a sports journalist who lives in Ashland and the author of the new book, Superfan, Into the Heart of Obsessive Sports Fandom. And George, we were before the break talking about sports psychologist Dan Juan, who really informed a lot of your book in terms of his study of the psychology of sports fans. And he's kind of among a breed of researchers that's pretty far down the pecking order when it comes to sports psychology as a field. It seemed like he was the group that played miniature golf with you was kind of a ragtag bunch of researchers.
They're all at these sort of smaller universities. Like no one is, you know, getting paid to study fans at, you know, Harvard or the University of Michigan or something like that. You know, they're at Southern Illinois and Kittstown in Pennsylvania and Western Kentucky and these kind of schools. So, and they just love fans. They're sports fans. They love it. And what happened was most of them would bump into Dan Juan at a conference or something and say, I had a kind of a curiosity about this. And he'd say, let's do a study together. And so the next thing you know, he kind of brings them into his orbit. And so he's brought together this group of, you know, maybe eight or so professors. And each year they get together in Kentucky and it's a conference, and I forget the name, but it's got some really, you know, highbrow sounding, you know, ivory tower name to it. But really it's the eight of them getting together, you know, in a classroom and talking. But before that, you know, getting together and playing miniature golf in this like indoor, you know, golfing center and talking trash to each other. And, you know, it is hilarious. And then they watch basketball. It's always during the NCAA tournament. So they go over to someone's house and watch basketball together. It is not a, you know, like this sort of think tank group that's coming together. It's a bunch of really fun people who happen to just also love studying fans.
One of the great stories in your book that is very close to home in Oregon is about a guy who is not one of those guys that's in a crazy wig with his face painted in the stands. But he's almost single-handedly responsible for the huge fan base of the Portland Timbers soccer team. It's a guy named whose nickname is Nevitz. Tell us about him.
Nevitz, yeah. Nevitz is Steven spelled backwards. His real name is Steven Lenhart, and he gave himself the name Nevitz when he was reading slam poetry in Portland coffee houses. So it stuck with him. And he loved soccer. He always loved soccer. He was a guy who, with his dad and brother, would go to minor league soccer games in Portland in the 80s and 90s, and he just always wanted people to love it like him. And single-handedly, he started an email list, and he started gatherings back before there were a Portland Timbers MLS team, long before. He just started collecting people bringing them around him. Let's watch soccer together. He had a card made up, and he'd run into people on the streets who happened to be wearing, say, an Adidas jacket, and he'd say, "Hey, do you love soccer? Come hang out with the Cascade Rangers." That was the name of the group that he gave. Well, when the Timbers were reborn, they realized, oh my goodness, this guy is our fan base. He's created our fan base. So they courted him, brought him in, and he, you know, in a very grassroots way, he and a few others started building up what is Timbers Army. And Timbers Army now is really one of the most powerful groups in Oregon. You know, they don't really get involved in politics, but one of the founders of it told me, look, if we did, he's actually a political consultant, told me if we wanted to, we could sway elections. That's how powerful Timbers Army is. So, and this started with a guy, you know, Nevitz, a guy who worked in coffee houses and breweries and liked to do slam poetry. And it's all because of him.
And they've been so successful with the fan base that this one guy built that other sports franchises are coming to the Portland Timbers and saying, how did you do this?
They go to games and they listen to the Timbers Army singing, standing and singing, chanting, all of the organization of it, the what they call TIFO, the huge displays that they put up before games that have, you know, imagery and all the fans are holding something up. And they say, how do we do this? And the response is, go find your Nevitz and get out of the way, which means you can't create it. You can't. It has to happen organically. It has to happen with just people who love the sport and give themselves over to the pursuit of growing the team and growing the fan base.
It's a great story, and it's got a very interesting ending that we're not going to share with you, the story of Nevitz. So I have to inject my own story into this narrative, my own fanboy story. So I grew up in Wisconsin, which means, of course, I'm a Packers fan.
Yes.
And I tell people I don't really care for football, but I am a Packers fan. But I met my wife here in Oregon, and she is also from Wisconsin. And when we met, she said, I'm so glad to have moved to Oregon so that I can get away from the insane obsession that every person in Wisconsin has with the Green Bay Packers. I mean, it is nuts because the utility boxes and fire hydrants in her hometown are painted green and gold. So it is kind of a state religion in Wisconsin. But in the last couple of years, we've started going to Packer games. We get dressed up in Packer gear. We go to bars. We have the Packer Everywhere app on our phones. So when we're in Portland, we know to go to the Corbett Fish House on Sunday if there's a Packer game, and everybody's wearing green and gold. I don't even recognize this woman anymore. She's like a Packers fan. And what resonated with me about that in your book was not only the Packers fan that you profile, but the story that the researcher, I think his name was Roger Aiden, mm-hmm. did about Nebraska Cornhuskers fans. It explained a lot to me. What tell us about that study.
Yeah, I love this study. Roger was a Cornhusker, born in Nebraska, and then went to the University of Nebraska. But then he ended up in Ohio, got a university job at the University of Ohio, and would find this like longing for Nebraska. So he would watch Nebraska games, and he would turn off the TV but like stream the Nebraska broadcast over his internet so that he could hear the commercials for, you know, grain services and, you know, farm equipment. He kind of wondered what it was. So he and some researchers went out and started calling, emailing, contacting Nebraska fans all over the country. And the conclusion that they reached through all this work, years of work, was that most Nebraskans, and this can apply to Green Bay Packers fans, absolutely, or Pittsburgh Steelers fans who also gather all across the country, is that they had what's called place attachment, that they just wanted to feel it like they were back home, a little something, slice of home. And regular people who aren't sports fans might have this with like their childhood home growing up, right? But so by going to a bar with Packer fans, and you know, the guy that I profile in my book, he goes with Packer fans to a Packers bar, and they tailgate outside the bar before the bar opens to show the Packer games. So they're grilling, they're tailgating out front of a bar, grilling brats, because of course they are, drinking some sort of Miller product, because that they have to. You know, they're doing that because they want to feel a little bit like they're back in Wisconsin. And I thought this explained so much behavior, this idea of, yes, that's it, right? We just want to feel, even if it's only for a few hours on Sunday, a little bit like we're back home, a little bit like, you know, I mean, Roger Aden was really reading Willa Cather and was comparing it to that, the idea of farm gatherings back in her time to Nebraska fans gathering. And I think there's some real truth there.
We have an email here. We're speaking with George Dorman about his new book called Superfans. This is from Mike in Medford. He says, did you compare international fans to American fans? He says, you know, as bad as we can be, we don't shut the country down or kill the refs when our team loses.
So the research that we talked about, Dan Juan has done a lot of research internationally and nationally. And I think that there are differences, of course, and some of those fan bases have a history of violence that we don't have in our country. But generally speaking, why people become fans, why they might ratchet up their fandom, you know, behaviorally in general, not the extreme behavior that you might see with violence, there's no difference. You know, how we become fans in the States versus overseas, it's the same. It's usually a parent, a sibling, or you go to a university. And, you know, the things that fandom impacts us, how it impacts us, like our self-esteem and those things, it's the same. So there are sort of historically, we've seen a lot of violence in, say, soccer in Europe and other places. But generally speaking, no, we're not really that different from the fans of over there.
So your book is titled Superfans, and it actually takes its title from a guy who is named Superfan. Tell us about him.
Yeah, Michael Hobson. I love Michael Hobson. He is a guy who grew up in Savannah, Georgia, poor, big family, and he loved art. But when you're, you know, a poor African-American kid in the South who's starting, who's working to help pay the rent at 12, there's not time for art. And it was just sort of stifled. And then at a certain point in his life, he moved to Indianapolis. He'd gotten laid off from his job at a coal plant. And he was working at a grocery store, and he just started collecting sort of found items, right? He would pull stuff out of the garbage. And then he got invited to go to a Colts game, and he started walking around. He put some stuff that he had found on his body, and he liked the way people reacted. And this then morphed into something amazing. He has dozens of these elaborate costumes that are made up, again, primarily stuff he pulls out of the garbage or people give to him for free. And they are art. I mean, you can't even see him, really. I mean, his face is covered. It's painted. He's got weird glasses that he adorns with different things. He's got hair. And, you know, he has thematic ones. He has a breast cancer awareness one. He has an Indiana Pacers one. He's got 10 Colts ones. It is incredible. He has a whole room in his house, walls covered with, you know, different ways to decorate himself. And this is just an amazing expression of his art. And in the book, I really talk about how everybody has a need they're filling when they ratchet up their fandom. And this is such an obvious one for Michael. He finally, you know, way too late, he finally found a way to express his art. And this was the way that he could do it and get the response that he was looking for. And it's really, again, you look at him and you'd say, that guy must be a little off. No, normal guy. You know, in a good relationship, it has a good job. He works hard. He's really nice. He's a fun guy to have dinner with. And he's really happy because he's
found this. He also has a huge public profile in Indianapolis. It seems like everybody knows him.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's famous. I mean, he when I was sitting with him, I was sitting with him at lunch once at a bar and grill in Indianapolis, and the manager came up. He wasn't in costume. And the manager came up and introduced himself and said, he knew him immediately and said, would you please come to the bar when, you know, some of these games are televised and you can, you know, you can eat for free and bring friends. I mean, he is just so well known when he walks around town and they, you know, he gets hired to come in and do events and things like that.
There's a picture of him in your book in one of his costumes. And I have to say, I was reminded of the Mardi Gras Indians in New Orleans, you know, who spend months and months and months, you know, painstakingly beating their costumes in these incredible expressions of their, you know, quote, tribal identity. And here's this guy, and he's got like weird, you know, skulls on him and all this stuff. But he's not just exclusively a Colts fan. He goes to Pacers games too,
and Pacers games, Indianapolis 500. You know, yeah, it's not. He's a fan. In fact, I had him take the SSIS, the test on how you score, and he didn't score at the extreme. You'd look at him and you would say, "Oh, he's an extreme." But see, he didn't score on the extreme because he doesn't really care if the teams win or lose. I mean, he does. He'd like to see the Colts win or the Pacers win, but it's not really that important to him. So he scored lower on that, which shows you again, it's not for him. This experience being a superfan is not about my team winning. It is about I can express my art, and this makes me happy and fills that need.
Right. So he doesn't curl up in a ball
exactly
when the team loses. My guest is George Dorman. He's a sports journalist, the author of a new book called Superfan, Into the Heart of Obsessive Sports Fandom. So when we see these extreme sports fans depicted on television especially, they're almost invariably men. But you profile several women sports fans in your book. What are the differences?
There are differences, but I think I'd like to say there's also one great similarity. There has been this sort of perception, I think, that people hold that women become fans because they had a boyfriend who was a fan or of a team or a husband, something like that. And there's actually a great researcher, in a woman in Australia who studied female fans. She calls this STF, sexually transmitted fandom. Well, yeah, right? And so what she found out was that that actually is rare. That's not that common for people to become fans because of a partner. Women become fans the same reason that men become fans, because their parents were fans, their siblings. They lived in a community like Green Bay, Wisconsin, where everybody's a fan, so you just become a fan, or you go to a university and you become a fan. So how women become fans is not different, really, from how men become fans. What Dan Wan and other researchers found, though, is that how fandom impacts men and women can differ. Men's self-esteem is tied up way more significantly in the results of games than women. So, you know, a team loses, a man's self-esteem might drop. They win, it goes up. Women don't have that fluctuations. They don't. Women also, when asked why they watch games, more of them enjoy both the social aspect of a group, of grouping, and to watch a game. And also most of them simply like to watch this beauty of the sport. They can watch a game and appreciate the brilliant athletes and, you know, the artistry of these sports. And so that was their response, was higher there, significantly higher than men. Men are, again, we are just slaves to our self-esteem. And one of my favorite studies of fans that was ever done was a professor at Indiana University asked, you know, after an Indiana win, showed college students, male college students, a picture of a beautiful woman and said, "Do you think you could date this woman?" And after a win, a high percentage of them said, "Yeah, I think I could date her." After a loss, he showed them a picture of a beautiful woman and, "Can you date her?" And the male students responded, "Oh, no, I don't think I can date her. I couldn't get her." So whether or not Indiana won or lost, it persuaded men that they could somehow date a more beautiful woman. It's just crazy how men react. Their self-esteem, their social well-being is impacted by you know, their team's wins and losses. Women, though, just aren't as impacted in that way.
And there's the dark side to that, too, because, you know, there are these apocryphal stories of the guy whose team loses and he goes home and commits acts of domestic violence or something, because I assume his self-esteem has been so tied up with the team. I don't know. I mean,
yeah, no,
you don't really touch on that in the book. But
yeah, the reason I don't touch on violence too much is, generally speaking, sports fans are not more violent. The studies that have been done show that sports fans are not more violent than the average person. We see it more, obviously. It gets highlighted more. If in the parking lot of a game, some Dodger fans beat up some Giants fans, there was a really high-profile incident a few years ago about that, and, you know, put that guy in a coma – that gets a lot of attention, and we start having discussions about violent sports fans. But really, guys beat up other guys outside of sporting events, you know, all the time, unfortunately. So it's not really – there's not – I think it gets portrayed that somehow sports fans are more violent. The studies show that they are not more violent than your average person.
George Dorman is our guest this morning. He's a sports journalist, a resident of Ashland, and the author of the new book, Superfan, Into the Heart of Obsessive Sports Fandom. You can join the conversation this morning, 800-838-3760, or by email at jx@jeffnet.org. We'll be back and spend some more time with George Dorman after this break. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm John Baxter, and today for Jeffrey Riley, we're talking with George Dorman. He's written a new book called Superfan, Into the Heart of Obsessive Sports Fandom. You can join us online by emailing us at jx@jeffnet.org, or you can call us in at 800-838-3760. And I wanted to, you know, you mentioned just before the break that there's studies that show that, sports fans are no more violent than the general population. But there is kind of a dark side to sports fandom in the sense that it does, it can create negative consequences for people. And if I can get Darnell's attention here, I'm going to ask him to play a clip from YouTube that is mentioned in
the
book.
Why are you so mad at Tom Brady? Well, I think Tom Brady's an idiot, too. He might throw a pick.
He never gives up. He always gets touchdowns.
Why don't you like Tom Brady so much? Because he's mean?
No, I hate him.
Oh, Christopher. Don't get so upset. Don't be so mad at Tom Brady.
I hate him, though. I think he can play a sport. He's
That clip, I hate Tom Brady, is on YouTube, and I don't know how many hits it's gotten over the years, but a lot of them. Billions, you mentioned that in your book, and you bring it up in the context of being a little bit concerned about the effect of extreme sports fandom on young kids.
Yeah, we indoctrinate kids into fandom these days. Parents, you know, they're putting Packers onesies or Oregon onesies on their kids in the crib. You know, we don't hide our fandom from our kids, and if anything, we introduce them to fandom. We make them fans of specific teams just by bringing it into their lives at such an early age. I wanted to know if this was a good thing. So I reached out to a couple of different people, and one of them was a child psychologist, a renowned child psychologist, Susan Harder. And, you know, she knows more about kids than anybody, really. And what she said was is that, you know, of course, sports participation can be a wonderful thing, and fandom can be a way for families to bond. But when I played her that YouTube video, I asked her to watch it. And what she was really distressed about in that clip and others is one thing that we do with fandom is we introduce hate, the concept of hate, to children. I mean, if you think about, you know, let's say I'm an Oregon fan and I say, gosh, I hate Washington. I say that in front of my kids. I'm introducing the concept of hate to them, and I'm introducing that you know, that there's something wrong with the University of Washington's team, its fans. So we teach kids to hate not only the opposing players, but also potentially the opposing fans of that team. And kids see the world in black and white, Susan told me. You know, they say things like, is this a girl street or a boy street? They want to divide the world very cleanly. And we do that. Fandom does that for them. There's, you know, Auburn bad, Alabama good, you know, those kind of things. As a kid, I was a Notre Dame fan. My dad went to Notre Dame. He told me people that went to USC, our rival school, weren't as smart and were bad people. Right? That was cemented in my brain as a little kid. It took a long time for me to realize, hey, that's probably not true across the board. So we are really, unfortunately, you know, by introducing kids at a young age to fandom, they're not ready for it. They have no perspective. They don't know that if your team loses one game, it's not the end of the world. Or if they lose in the Super Bowl, they can look back and say, well, it was a good season even though we lost at the end. They don't have that perspective. So it really becomes kind of a dangerous thing, that the way we're introducing it to kids at a young age. And Susan says, look, we shouldn't be introducing fandom to kids until adolescence, 12, 13 years old. Because then, you know, if daddy's favorite team loses and he curls up in a ball and is a mess, the kids go, well, it's just, you know, he's upset, but it'll be okay. It's not the end of the world. A 5-year-old, a 6-year-old, you know, a younger kid, they don't understand that. They just see dada screaming at the TV mad, or they see dada melting down in some way.
There's we had an email earlier, and then another email from Tim and Eureka that I'm just going to somewhat paraphrase as part of my next question. But people are concerned about the sort of tribal aspects of team sports, and as you mentioned, you know, teaching people to, especially young kids, to hate the fans of other teams and that sort of thing. When I picked up your book before I read it, I was expecting it to be like another book that I read about extreme fandom. And I don't know whether you know this book. It's called Among the Thugs.
Sure. Yeah.
It's a very famous book about, you know, the extreme soccer hooligans in Britain who are incredibly violent and incredibly tribal. But the thing that really is remarkable about your book is that the vast majority of the people that you spent time with, these extreme fans, whether it be the, you know, the Vikings fans who have organized their fan club along the lines of the military, because most of them were in the military, or this young woman from Baker City who uses her Seattle Seahawks fandom as really is kind of a healing sort of redemption tool because she's had a horrible life. But most of these people are using fandom in very positive ways, and they're living normal, productive, happy lives.
That's something that I think I'm glad you underlined, because like the guys at the Viking World Order, you know, these guys are incredible, passionate fans, and that chapter about them is really about tribalism, about the idea of forming groups and why we group and what we get out of it. Those guys are normal guys. The head guy that I profile works at a halfway house for, you know, mentally disabled individuals, and he's really good at it. Like, he's this, you know, sort of big gentle bear, and he's so good at his job. But he also happens to be this fan who's going around knighting others, and they get tattoos, and they give out, you know, as you said, he's a general in the Viking World Order. I mean, he has a great quote in the book where he says, you know, he sort of got lost in the tunnel of make-believe, a reference to, you know, Mr. Rogers.
That was a great quote.
Yeah,
right?
So I think that's something just really important for the most people, the vast amount of people. The fandom, this extreme fandom, is really healthy. They have a need, you know, whatever it may be, whether they're an exhibitionist or whether they just need order in their lives, or whether, you know, like Wendy Bromley, you were mentioning, the Seahawks fan, they need something to help them heal. It serves a really positive purpose in their lives. It is not a negative.
It's the Jefferson Exchange here on Jefferson Public Radio. Our guest is George Dorman, the author of Superfan. We're going to take a call from Paul in Grants Pass. Hi, Paul.
It is wonderful to hear your dulcet tones on the radio again. I'm an alumnus of Southern and an alumnus of Jefferson Public Radio. And years ago, I was a student at Southern, and I had a buddy of mine, Mike Evans. I was supposed to go to Georgetown. He was supposed to go to Toledo, to a university back there for graduate work. He went to Toledo, and he was with his friends back there, and each of them got up and sang their college fight song until it came around to Mike. And he had no idea. We didn't know what the college fight song was for Southern Oregon College at that time, the Red Raiders. There is such a profound difference between the Pacific Northwest, or at least rural Pacific Northwest, and the rest of the country on that. It was just hilarious when he told me this story, because of course he just big eyes and said, "I don't have a clue." Now, on the other side of this thing, I think that people can do cathartic work. I think you made a very good point with that. However, your king of the Viking nation drilled it. He wound up going into a fantasy land that causes him to be distracted from all of the real world stuff he's dealing with. Now maybe that's a good thing, maybe it's not, but what I see with fandom is I see a lot of people avoiding a lot of issues that need to be faced and dealt with. And I'll take your comments to that off the air.
George, any reaction to those comments?
Yeah, you know, like guys that I'm talking about, David Garza, the Viking World Order, as I said, he's a really productive member of society. And the you know, he has a full-time job helping the mentally disabled. He's really good at it. The Viking World Order does a ton of charity work. I think that the fantasy that you're talking about, that they dip into, it exists on Sunday for a couple hours when they put on their get-ups and they go to the games or they watch the games on TV. But other than that, you know, they're engaged in the world in the same way. I do think you're correct that some people can take this too seriously, and it really gets into, you know, the term addiction versus obsession. That's something that I talk to clinical psychologists about. And look, there's no difference between fandom and – well, there is a difference, but fans can get addicted to their team. But that does exist. But most people are just obsessed, and there's a little bit – there's a difference there. The clinical psychologists don't like you calling fans addicts because, you know, a lot of these people, like Diggs Garza, the Viking World Order, their fandom is not impacting their job. It's not impacting them financially. It's not impacting their marriage or their family life. So those are the markers that clinical psychologists look for to say this is an addiction. They have none of those. So I think, again, generally I think it can be a really healthy thing if they limit sort of how much time they spend in the fantasy land that he's talking about.
Another aspect that you bring up in your book is how sports fans deal with disappointment. For me, it was having to see Brett Favre in a Vikings uniform. But in your book, you talk about how Oklahoma City basketball fans dealt with the fact that Kevin Durant moved to the Golden State Warriors. What happened there?
There is a psychologist actually use this term, people who study sports fans, they use a term called blasting, right? It doesn't seem like it's something a psychologist would come up with, but it's true, they did. And, you know, we see it on social media, we see it everywhere where, you know, fans, when something like Kevin Durant leaving your favorite team happens, what can you do about that? Well, you're not the general manager. You can't go out and sign another player. You can't make a trade. You're not going to quit being a fan of the Oklahoma City Thunder because it's too much of who you are, your identity. It's your social circle. You're sort of stuck. What do you do? What you do is you blast them. So you go on to Kevin Durant's the Yelp page for Kevin Durant's restaurant in Oklahoma City, and you give it horrible reviews. You go on social media and you send, you know, tweets at him or in some other forum, you go after him. This is just fans, they took their self-esteem took a huge blow. Kevin Durant left or something like that happens. A coach quits for a better job, which says that job is better than your favorite team's job. This is a blow. It's a blow to our self-esteem. And so how do we cope with that? A lot of people cope with it by going after the individual who hurt them, maybe going after an opposing fan base and criticizing them. You know, this is how we cope with a jolt to our self-esteem.
So in reading this book, I was repeatedly struck by the ability of sports to overcome social differences. And we're in a period in our country's history right now where there's extreme chasms between various cultures or tribes. The word gets used a lot. Do you still think that sports can help us cross those divides that are seemingly widening in this country?
I think it's one of the few things that blend people with different worldviews. There's just not many things left. We are now dividing ourselves where we live, where we worship, where we go to school, all of these things. We're just choosing more and more. What news, where we get our news, we're just choosing to divide ourselves up. But no matter your sort of political views, your social views, you know, you can share this fandom with somebody. And, you know, look, I went around the country and talked to all these fans, and many of them are very, very different than I am. But we sat down and we talked about their team, what was going to happen in the upcoming season, you know, how they became a fan, why they love that team, who their favorite player is. And we're sitting there having a great conversation, bonding. These are people that I still interact with now because I just like them. And so we hold different views, absolutely. But there, you see them as people. You see them as individuals. You see that, you see the intricacies of their life, the complexities of their story, and it allows you to maybe see their side of things, or not condemn at least them for having a different view than you.
George Dorman, I'd love to spend another hour talking about your book, Superfans. George Dorman's an Ashland resident and author of a new book, Superfans, about extreme sports fandom. George, thanks for joining with us on the Jefferson Exchange.